Believe it or not, Terry, Richard and Anna, we have a science teacher on the telephone line, and she is, of course, Dr. Louise Firth, who is a lecturer in zoology in NUI Galway. Good afternoon, Dr. Louise Firth.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
Very well indeed. Are you going by any chance to the Science Teachers Association conference?
No, I'm not. Not this weekend.
Well, indeed, we all, I suppose, have a love of science, the four of us around the table, and indeed you. And before I introduce you properly, let me just go back in time and recap, because last week in the programme, we spoke to the man responsible for counting how many butterflies in Ireland. Now, Dr. Tomás Murray is an ecologist with the National Biodiversity Data Centre, and he told us how using citizen scientists, in inverted commas, around the country helped him to get very valuable data about butterfly populations. And as I said, in our Galway studios is a woman who's looking for citizen scientists. She wants them to count the sea urchins and limpets and barnacles in all the rock pools and crevices around the shores of the west of Ireland. This is Dr. Louise Firth, who's a lecturer in zoology at NUI Galway. Tell me first about, first question, you are a benthic marine ecologist. Now, I might know my science some little bit, although I've forgotten a lot of it. Tell me, Louise, what is a benthic marine ecologist?
Well, a benthic marine ecologist is somebody who studies the organisms that live on the sea bottom. And my particular interest is intertidal sea bottoms. So they're the organisms that live on rocky shores, effectively the area when the tide goes out, the organisms that are emerged when the tide is out, effectively.
So I was asking this to Anna earlier. I was also getting a lesson up. I was back in school with Anna there a while ago. And basically, this is about the shallow sea floor. It's not very deep what you're looking at, really, is it?
No, not really. No, like I say, when the tide is out, you're actually able to get down there and see the organisms for yourself. But of course, when the tide comes back in, they're covered and you won't be able to see them.
So you're really looking at the marine community ecology. Tell me all about this, Louise.
Marine community ecology or the project?
The project.
The project. Yeah, it's a project called The Shore Thing. It was originally established in the UK, led by the Marine Biological Association of the UK in Plymouth. And at the moment, it's currently the largest citizen science or outreach project that relates to the marine environment in the UK. Now, last year, they established some surveys in Northern Ireland, but this year is the first time that it's actually been established in the Republic. And I was very happy to get some funding from the Irish Research Council to enable me to initiate this. So it's very much just the first steps of the project and really more at this point, creating awareness for it. And hopefully people will develop an interest in it and will establish it in their own areas.
So, Louise, you are interested, I think, in the changes that are taking place. The sea is changing rapidly. Well, relative to us, it's not very rapid. But in geological terms, it's enormous. The sea is warming up. Its salinity is changing. Its acidity is changing. All sorts of things are happening. And this could be reflected, or should indeed be reflected, in the animals. We know, for instance, that the eel collapsed completely on one of the eels that come from the Sargasso Sea to Ireland. They dropped off enormously in the last few years. So huge changes are taking place and they are due to changes in the sea, presumably. Now, you are in a key position if you look at the rock pools over decades to notice changes of that kind. Is that what you're at and have you noticed much to date?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, that's my own particular research interest as a scientist. But this project follows what was called the Marklin Project, which is also called the Marine Biodiversity and Climate Change Project. And this was a very large project, again, initiated in the UK, but did have some Irish partners at UCC. And they were one of the first to publish strong evidence to suggest that climate change was having a very significant impact on the distribution of rocky shore organisms. Now, if you consider rocky shore organisms, when the tide is in, they're exposed to marine conditions, and then when the tide is out, they're exposed to aerial conditions. So they really are at the forefront of any changes that are happening both in the sea and in the air. And what we found from the Marklin project was that a large group of species are changing their distributions. And we're ideally placed here in the UK and Ireland because the two islands straddle what we call a biogeographic boundary zone. And what that really means is that we have a lot of northern species that tend to coexist with a lot of southern species, and the two islands are effectively an area of overlap. So really you can consider the British Isles as the canary in the mine when it comes to marine species and climate change, because this is where you're going to see some of the first effects happening.
So, Lise, you're actually asking people to go out to rocky shores, because there's obviously these creatures only occur on rocky shores. There's no point in going to sand dunes. There's no point in going to cliffs. It's the rocky shores which are exposed when the tide is out. And you want them to look in the pools and you want them to say what creepy, animals that there are there. So you're going to get things like anemones. You're going to get things like periwinkles. You're going to get top shells. Do the plain people of Ireland know these animals, and will they be able to record them properly for you?
A lot of people will be quite familiar with them as you know, from rock pooling as children. And it's not so much of a problem if people aren't comfortable and not really so sure what a limpet or a barnacle or a top shell is. We have a rocky shore survey guide and also a series of timed species search ID cards. And they are very nicely illustrated with photographs and information about the habitats that these organisms are found in. So the actual survey comprises two different parts. First of all, we do what we call a transect survey, where we get groups of volunteers going along a transect from the high shore to the low shore when the tide is out. And they place quadrats, which are effectively square survey units, in the high shore, the mid shore and the upper shore. Or sorry, the high shore, the mid shore and the lower shore.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And they count everything that they can identify in these quadrats. And they can use the Rocky Shore Survey Guide to help them to ID a lot of the organisms that they're going to find. Now, things like the red seaweeds would be very difficult to identify, and we wouldn't be expecting people to be able to go to that kind of level. So it really is designed for the public and for volunteers to get involved. You don't need to have a very, you know, strong background in rocky shore organisms to be able to do it.
But of course, this is typical now of what the leaving cert students will be doing for their biology subject. If you're going to be studying a habitat and you live beside the sea, the rocky shore is one that's traditionally done, and the teachers in school will have been doing this with their pupils. So a lot of information might already exist in science teachers' copies or in the pupils' copies, as they have been doing these transects over the years. So is this an area that you could mine profitably, asking teachers to give you the results that they've done with their classes over the last few years?
Absolutely, yeah. It works both ways. We could get our hands on those data if they were willing to provide them. But in addition, they could adopt a Shore Thing survey and do that as part of the Leaving Cert course as well. So if people were interested, they can log on the website to see if it's applicable to what they're doing. And the Marine Biological Association have a really good website, and you can download all sorts of materials from a really in-depth teacher's pack. You can download the shore survey guide, the ID cards, and also the recording forms as well. So it's all there available on the website if people are interested.
So these websites that you're speaking of then, we can leave a link to those from our particular website here, the Mooney Shore website.
That
so that
great.
People don't have to be remembering. Terry, do you bring people out like that?
Yes, I do. We go to different habitats. Personally, I like the hedgerow. I often go to the bog. But the reason why I don't go to the seashore is because it's a little bit more difficult to get to it. But I know, for instance, Enfo many years ago did that survey with the lichens, and they asked teachers to send information in. I think you were involved in that. This is going back to the 80s
indeed,
it was fantastic information that was sent in. So what I would like to see is that if you were to get in touch with, say, the Science Teachers Association, biology teachers, and also the NCCA, because I know there are going to be changes to the courses coming in the near future, and it would be great that we could work towards that so that the students, when they go out and they're doing research, it's actually research that will go towards something, that it will be published in the future.
Louise, have you seen any changes yet, have you? I mean, you've been working on this for a few years. Are we getting southern species more familiarly on the West Coast, and are we losing species because they're shoving off further north?
Yeah, we definitely are. I mean, we know a lot more from survey work that's been done in the UK, but certainly the same is happening here in Ireland, and we would expect the same things to be happening. There isn't as much work being done here, but certainly we are expecting that, given the location, the northern species that occur here, we would generally expect that a lot of those will retract their ranges and move further north.
So which ones are they? Say a few names.
Yeah, probably the very obvious ones that people might be familiar with would be the common limpet. So this would be the one that I know when I talk to people about limpets, they remember them as the things that they kick off the rocks as kids. Mm. But the one that lives on the rock would be a northern species that's retracting its range, and it's expected to go locally extinct in some places.
Southern one
before
coming
up before there. You yeah. leave that, Louise, why is this due to reproductive failure, due to change in temperature, or
competition from southern ones?
Acidity or whatever? Or is it that they are dying off? It's a mortality thing, or is it a reproductive thing, do you think? This is going on since the 1950s now, this survey in Britain, so you must have a fair handle on the main trends.
Yeah, no, it's a mixture of lots of different things. It's a colder water species, so just warmer temperatures are affecting it, particularly at the juvenile stages. The adults are a bit more robust and they're able to cope a lot better with temperature fluctuations.
But is it shifting north then?
It is, yeah. No, it's.
Are there increases in Scotland and Norway and Iceland and places like that? Is it increasing its diversity up there? Is it just a move out sort of thing?
We don't know what's going on further north, mostly because people aren't really working on it. But certainly further south in Britain, it is becoming less abundant in the southwest. And certainly further south of its range, its current known southern limit is in Portugal, and it is very much reducing in abundance down there.
Louise, I don't know if you've been in touch with Matt Murphy from Sherkin Island, but I know Matt has been doing tremendous research down on Sherkin and Roaring Water Bay for something like 40 years now. And I've been down there a number of times, and he's got, I think, the largest private library certainly in Europe. And he has certainly got lots of information that I think would be of great help to you.
That sounds great. I must get in touch with them. Thank you.
And he's also got a book, a guidebook to the species of the Rocky Shore.
He's a number of them here.
Yeah, but the Rocky Shore one is very good. But tell me, what southern species are increasing? Name one that's increasing.
Well, there's a couple of top shells that people might be quite familiar with. The purple top shell, which is Gibula umbilicalis, and also the larger one, which is found slightly higher up on the shore, called Forcus lineatus. Both of those are increasing in abundance and shifting their ranges northwards as well. And then also things like the small periwinkle, people probably wouldn't really see that one so much. It tends to be in little crevices higher up on the shore. But certainly that is another one that's increasing in abundance and moving northwards.
That group are quite difficult to tell apart from the outsider. You know, I mean, the range of periwinkles and little whelky things is quite considerable.
Yeah, there's good colour variation.
Are there a few that are obvious? You mentioned the two top shells. I think that's the ones with the sort of zebra-type stripes.
That's
on
right.
Them.
And
yeah.
the mother of
now,
pearl inside.
But
yeah.
how do you... I would find it difficult, I must say, to tell the large one from the small one all the time. So that's kind of a difficult one. It's typical of the kind of difficulty that these little whelk shells produce. Are there ones that are markers that are foolproof that you can look at year in, year out in the same pool and come up with an estimate of what's happening?
Yeah, there are three species of top shell that you will find on Irish shores. And all of them, when you know, of course, they're quite easy to tell apart. The biggest one is the easiest because it's so big. The other ones don't get that size. But the distinguishing feature is on the inside of the operculum, which is the little opening, there's a little tooth sticking out, and neither of the other two species have that. So if it has the little tooth, you know that it's that species. And then the other two, they look quite similar, but one has a little belly button on the inside and the other one doesn't have a little belly button, or umbilicus, as we call it. So that's the... You can tell the differences, and I would be able to. I would be confident that members of the public would be able to tell the differences once they know how.
It's all right to handle them to check for that. I mean, take them off and they're stuck onto the rock, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's nothing wrong with that. I always feel a little bit uneasy about doing that. Should you put it back with the operculum down so it can lodge on? If I leave it lying on its back, will it be all right? Will it manage to turn itself around and lock onto the rock?
Oh, the worry of it all.
The worry of it all. This is neurosis, I'm sorry.
No, the top shells are okay. It's the limpets, the ones that you kick off. You shouldn't be kicking those
that.
Off.
That's very bold.
You shouldn't do that.
That's very bold. Yeah, it's very bold. But the top shells can roll around.
So top shells are all right to turn around.
Yes. They'll be okay. Yes. No. Don't kick limpets off the rock.
No, I wouldn't. Would I? Yeah,
so. Now, you're obviously, Louise, a very busy scientist because you're involved as well, I believe, in a bio blitz. Am I right? In Derrynane.
That's right. Yes. We're hoping to do a Sure Thing survey as part of the bio blitz down in Derrynane.
Sounds wonderful.
When is that?
That's Saturday, the 24th of May.
And can people come along to see what you're doing so
Absolutely.
That they can learn stuff?
Yep, yeah, that's wide open for people to come and have a look and get involved.
As always, we invite our listeners to join us in the conversation by texting us, and the text machine is going fairly busy, 51551. Can you please ask if the populations of sand eels off the south and west coast are adapting to warming seas better than the sand eels off the Scottish coast? Now, who would like to take that question? Louise.
Can I opt not to take that question?
They're not bending. No, the sand eels are
It's called
food.
Pass, Louise. That's the one. Yeah,
they're the food for the nesting seabirds. So the measure of the success of the sand eels is shown by the measure of the breeding seabirds. And we'll ask our seabirds expert, Richard Collins.
Well, the figure for Scotland is about a 5% decline in every two years, compound interest, way back since 1980-something. So it is clear that the sand eel population is going down, or else moving northwards. That's not clear. There's been suggestions that the further the Nordic colonies in Norway and in Iceland are not as great. They don't take up the slack that's being lost further south, but this is a bit hairy, all of this. Mm. It's certainly true that these things are declining. Puffins are feeding on things like pipefish, which are nutrient value is nothing like what it was.
But the question is,
are they declining? The evidence is that they are declining.
No, the question is, are they declining more in Scotland than they are in the southwest,
yes,
in Kerry?
Well,
so are the birds in Scotland doing worse than the birds in Kerry that feed on sand eels? I think that's really the question.
Yeah. I would think the as much the same here as in the north of Scotland. I wouldn't expect much, but I don't think we have the figures here. We haven't the manpower to assess this in the way the British have, because they have huge numbers of people to check these things out in detail.
Check with Matty Murphy, I'd say, is the first thing. He has great results.
Kevin Flannery in the Dingle Aquarium would certainly have something to say on this, because he's very close to this sort of thing.
Okay, Louise, just in terms of this project, just to recap, what do you want people to do, schools? What can they do to help you? The Citizen Project.
I would say log on to the website, have a look at it, see if you're interested in it, and then get in touch. We have a series of surveys that we're going to be doing on the west coast of Ireland, one of which is the Derry Nan Bio Blitz. But if people are interested and it's local to them, get involved and come along. And if they're interested in just adopting the short thing, they can also download a lot of the materials from the website as well, and just do it that way.
Okay, well, it's a wonderful project. We hope you get a very positive response. We have the information on our own website here on the Mooney Show as well, so you can look us up, or indeed look up what Louise has said. Before I go, I'm big into accents and names. The name Firth immediately signals for me, anyway, a famous actor called Colin Firth. You're not related, Louise, are you?
No, I'm not.
It sounded like a good story if you were, though. You know?
It would have been good, no.
Where is his surname from?
It's a Scottish surname. So not many Firths in Ireland, but plenty of us over in Scotland, none of which are my relations. But it's a Scottish surname.
But were you born and bred in Ireland, or have you come to join us?
Born and bred. My grandparents were from Ireland. At some point, I guess an ancestor came over at some point and established here, but I'm not sure when exactly that was.
Okay, that's for another programme. We'll investigate Louise Firth's background. Dr. Louise Firth, lecturer in zoology at NUI Galway, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Mooney Show.
Thank you.